The views and opinions expressed on the following program are not necessarily those of the staff and management of KLAY or those who advertise their products or services on this station.
Welcome to Noah Your Rights, the show dedicated to helping educate you, the listener, on your legal rights and resources available. Our goal, to empower you and put you in charge of your case. I'm your host, Attorney Noah Davis, broadcasting live from the studios of KLAY 1180 AM in Tacoma, Lakewood, Washington. Be sure to check out our website at www.noahyourrights.com as we post the audio for each show as well as follow-up information on each program. This is episode 26 of Noah Your Rights. Today, we are joined by Lori Jenkins from the Washington State Representative from the 27th District. Lori, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Noah.
For those of you that want to learn some introductory information about the Washington legislature, you can find that information in episode 16 of Noah Your Rights, which can be found on our website, www.noahyourrights.com. If you're interested in calling in today, telephone number is 253-581-0324. That's 253-581-0324. Today, we're going to focus more on the Judiciary Committee than the state, the House, generally speaking. We're going to talk about a few statutes, including the Domestic Violence Protection Act, the Anti-SLAPP Act, and the Public Disclosure Law, if we have time, if we make it there. But first, Lori, for our listeners, I was hoping you could share a little bit about your background and who you are. Who makes Lori Jenkins?
Well, we'll finish that in about an hour and a half or something like that. No, I'll try and be brief, but and hit on some important things. I grew up in a very rural Midwestern town of 500 people, dairy farming country, and my dad was a large animal veterinarian. And so I learned a lot from living in a small town about how much anything you wanted to do in your town, everybody had to be a part of it to make it happen. So, you know, growing up in high school, if we wanted to put on a play, everybody had to be in the play in some way. Everybody had to play in the band. Everybody had to play sports. And the other kind of great thing it taught me was that I didn't have to be the best at everything, but I could still contribute even if I wasn't the best. And it also helped me be better. But anyway, I went to the University of Wisconsin and got a bachelor's degree in business and a master's degree in healthcare administration, then came out here to what was the University of Puget Sound School of Law, went to law school, practiced at the Attorney General's office for a couple of years doing child abuse and neglect cases. It was an incredible experience. And then I felt like my master's degree in healthcare administration was getting really stale. So I went to work for the Department of Health for many years, regulating the healthcare industry and doing public health work, but really not as a lawyer. So after the AG's office, I really didn't practice law, and I haven't practiced law for a long time. I work here for the Tacoma Pierce County Health Department now when I'm not serving in the legislature. And I spent, you know, as I guess the things that prepared me for the legislature were my work on LGBTQ rights issues, and I served on an incredible number of nonprofit boards in the community. Have no shortage of things that really interest me and that I love in our community. I also served on the Tacoma Community College Board of Trustees, so got an educational background there. I kiddingly tell people that I'm fairly political, but I'm not the most political because I never served as a PTA board president, which my wife did. And I think that's the most political job you can actually have.
Right. Well, growing up in the Midwest, in Wisconsin, and you talked to about, I guess, the theory of it takes a village to raise someone. And that philosophy, I think, holds true. And it probably helps you in the legislature now because it's about teamwork and everyone coming together to reach an end, to reach a positive end.
Yeah, and that's actually, I think, even more true in the House than in the Senate. One of the things that we frequently talk about in Olympia, there's 98 members in the House, and getting bills passed in the House is, we often talk about it being a team sport. In the Senate, it's more of an individual sport. There's 48 of them. Every senator, you know, has kind of their individual areas that they focus on. And, you know, we obviously have to work a lot together, but it's one of the reasons why I've loved serving in the House is I realize that team sports are my thing. They're the thing that I enjoy is relying on other people's strengths and combining them with mine to make something better than what either one of us could do alone happen.
The soccer teams are in the House, the tennis players and the individual sports are in the Senate, then that's what it sounds like.
That's kind of how I think about it. Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah. So you've been serving as representative in the 27th district. I believe this is your eighth year
Yes.
now. So has that, this length of time, I mean, one thing that the House does that's unique is you run for election every 2 years. So that's sort of this perpetual election cycle, which makes it really tough, I would think, to be able to accomplish all the things that you want to do, especially in such a short term. But after 8 years, has that time helped develop you as a representative? And what would you, are there things that have changed over that time? And have you changed in your philosophy too?
I don't know that my philosophy has changed, but I do think serving the legislature has helped me clarify my values. I definitely thought that I understood my values when I ran for office, but running for office helped clarify them more. I was elected in 2010 and started my service in 2011. That was the height of the recession, and those were the first years where we were making drastic budget cuts because of the revenue shortfalls in Washington State. And I frequently tell people there is nothing that helps you clarify your values like having something like that happen. I mean, people often think about it maybe being difficult to choose between good and bad. I don't think that's hard. Most people know what they think is wrong and what they think is right. But when you have to make choices amongst a lot of things that you think are right and are good to be doing, but you cannot do them all and you have to prioritize them, that's an amazing and difficult experience of values clarification. And it's one that I honestly think everyone in our community should have, that because those were really some of the toughest years of my life, having to make decisions about cutting budgets for programs that were really working for the people of the state, but we just didn't have the revenue to do it.
Yeah, and that theme continues, I think, to today, and you're continuing having to choose between good and other good programs of which ones to defund or cut or reduce the budget for. And then I think about the McCleary decision. You have the Supreme Court of Washington saying, legislature, you're going to be held in contempt unless you fund public education. And a lot of the public then rises up and says, oh, the legislature, you're bad, you're not helping our kids. But the reality is there's just not funds for everything. And when I interview you, I interview Mike Pelliciotti, I interview other members of the Senate or the House of Representatives, I think these are really good people making tough decisions. It's not like you're out there trying to not fund public education. I mean, you're doing the right thing with the limited funds that are available because people don't want to pay taxes and give up all their revenue to the state. Right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, and I would say this is another huge learning that I've had as a legislator, is that I always thought that I understood incrementalism and taking incremental steps. But so often the incremental steps that you take forward are so small, they're almost imperceptible to people. And I'll use a different example with you. The committee that I chair, gun violence is one of the issues that we deal with. So all the firearm legislation comes to me. And to my committee. And a lot of people who don't pay a huge amount of attention to Olympia would say we haven't done anything. And that's not true. But we could have been doing more if we had the votes for it. But I look at little things like when I started chairing that committee, I was really only allowed to have one hearing on gun responsibility every year. Mm. That was it. Mm. Well, I'm now 5 years in. We basically hear as many bills as I want to hear. We still have a struggle moving them forward, but I do think that we've been able to show that the whole place doesn't have to fall apart if we talk about different approaches to gun violence and how to curb that. But those are such incremental steps,
right,
that it is, again, almost imperceptible to people. And so that sometimes I worry a little bit that I've gotten much too comfortable with those very, very small incremental steps. So that's always a balance piece, I think, that we have to have when we get elected and are serving down there.
And I believe that, it sounds like we're going to just take a short break. Stay with us, listeners. We're going to be right back. We're here with Lori Jenkins. And you're listening to Know Your Rights.
Deal Talk. To make sure my new Spicy Chicken Club combo is a great value, I asked a sales expert.
It's amazing, Jack! You get a spicy, crispy chicken breast, hickory smoked bacon, and melted cheese on toasted sourdough, plus fries and a drink. All in one delicious deal!
You said it, Stanley.
Ow. Wait, what's happening?
Stanley? Stanley, you're deflating!
I'm so cold.
We need a doctor!
Jack, tell my wife I love her.
No! Try my new Spicy Chicken Club combo. Another great deal from Jack in the Box.
Hi, I'm Noah from Noah Your Rights, the show that helps educate you on your legal rights and resources available to you. You know, I want to be your lawyer, but more than that, I want to help empower you. I want to help provide you the tools that you need to be successful in your case, whether you hire me or you hire someone else. I want you to check out our website, www.noahyourrights.com. See what resources are there. See how we can help you. And if there's something that's missing, email me at noah@noahyourrights.com, and we'll see what we can do to add the material that you need to be successful in your case.
Hey parents, finding it hard to communicate with kids in today's world of ever-changing slang?
Hi son.
Excuse me?
Introducing the Communicizer. Just strap non-toxic Communicizer to your mouth and go from boring old man speak.
Oh, you know, I'm here if you want to talk.
To 100% off the chain.
Text me whenever, yo.
It's that easy.
Thanks to Communicizer, I'm relevant to my kids again. I mean, a fly, boo.
And now when you buy Communicizer, you get the auto-tune attachment free. Sounds so hip-hop, your kids will want to talk to you for hours.
I used to have to walk 3 miles uphill to school every morning, shorty.
I love you, Dad.
I love you too, son.
Communicizer is not available in stores because it doesn't exist. But that's okay. You don't have to be perfect to be a perfect parent. Because kids in foster care don't need perfection. They need you. For more information on how you can adopt, go to AdoptUsKids.org. A public service announcement from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Adopt Us Kids, and the Ad Council.
I've gone to the...
Welcome back to Noah Your Rights, a show dedicated to helping you, the listener, be informed and educated about your legal rights and resources available to you. Make sure you check out our website, www.noahyourrights.com, as we post the audio for each show and additional information that can help you with your case. If you have any questions for our guest, Lori Jenkins, today from the Washington State House of Representatives, you're welcome to give us a call, 253-581-0324. So, Lori, just before the break, we were talking a little bit about your background as a representative, where you came from, who makes Lori today. And, you know, a couple of the things that you, as you were talking, I realized I see you out at so many different community events. I see you at whether it's a political event or just a straight community event, a community forum type event, you're always there and you have this incredible energy and devotion to the people. And I think that your nephews and nieces and folks in your family must call you Superwoman. I don't know how you do it.
I do have a little bit of a Wonder Woman collection. But, you know, I guess thank you for saying that, Noah, because I tend to be fairly critical of myself about not being out enough. But I guess the fact of the matter is I really love this community and I love being in community. And I feel like this community raised me to be who I am. And so I just feel like I'm out with my family all the time. And, you know, I have a wife and a son, and my son is 17. Our son is 17 and he's less interested in being out, you know, actually out with us. Now, but my wife is no less active than I am, and we both just really love the community we live in.
Well, for Halloween, when we come, when I bring the kids by your house, I'm going to be looking for you as a Wonder Woman to answer the door.
I do have a really great Wonder Woman apron. I'm not sure I can carry off the true Wonder Woman outfit, but the apron is pretty
right,
good.
Fair enough. Before we switch over to the Judiciary Committee and get into some of the legal ramifications for the work that you do, I just wanted to make mention that in your capacity now as Deputy Director of the Pierce County Health Department, that we might have to have you back for another show. Just to talk about food safety, food and health related issues that are important to Pierce County, if we could do that. And also that would cover, I think, the Puyallup Hospital, the hepatitis outbreak, and those sorts of things, although some of those things are sensitive. But if you'd be willing to do that, I'd sure like to have you back on some of those topics.
Yeah, so I'm not the deputy director at the health department anymore. I have a different title. Happy to come back anytime. And it's likely that there's better people to talk about some of those issues at the health department than me. But of course, I'm a lawyer, so I'll talk about it whether I know anything about it or not.
Well, sounds good. Sounds good. So, Judiciary Committee, you chair that particular committee and the Washington State House of Representatives. I went online to the state legislature today, and I saw that there's about 20 standing committees, and then there's a number of these ad hoc type task force committees. But the of the 20, the Judiciary Committee, in my mind, would tend to be pretty darn important. And when I think about it, I think about the federal House of Representatives and their Judiciary Committee, and I think that... I draw parallels from that, but I guess I don't have a good sense exactly of what the Judiciary Committee does and how it's different from all the other standing committees. So maybe you could give both me and our listeners a little bit of rundown of the distinction between the different committees.
Yeah, so let me just tell you how committees, every committee has jurisdiction, and every 2 years, whichever party has the majority sits down and reviews the jurisdiction of every committee in the House of Representatives, maybe tweaks their jurisdiction, and then bills should flow to that committee based on that committee's jurisdiction. So I also sit, for example, on the Healthcare and Wellness Committee. And when you hear the name Healthcare and Wellness, what do you think goes to that committee?
I would think health and wellness.
Yeah, and that's just it. Like, all healthcare bills go there, right? It's pretty straightforward in that sense. There's a lot of bills that go there. There's also a local government committee, so that's dealing with really regulation of local government or the extension of authority to local governments. The environment committee, again, exactly what you think it would do, bills that relate to the environment. Although, right, it's very interesting because, for example, the Growth Management Act, some of those bills might go to the local government committee, some of those go to the environment committee. So there's often kind of little tiffs and discussions between chairs about where a bill should go. The Judiciary Committee probably has some of the broadest jurisdiction of any committee, and we actually have the highest number of bills referred to us of any committee in the legislature.
It's almost like, well, where does this bill fit? Okay, it doesn't fit in environmental, it doesn't fit in health and wellness, let's send it over to Judiciary.
We do have a jurisdiction. So, for example, anything that is very technical legal stuff tends to come to us. So, landlord-tenant law, very technical, that comes to the Judiciary Committee. But the establishment of housing, per se, those issues go to a different committee. But we do landlord-tenant law. Mental health law comes to us because people are civilly committed or they're sent to for forensic treatment. So that's in the Judiciary Committee. All of the state's anti-discrimination laws. So a couple years ago when you were seeing a number of bills targeting the transgender community, all those bills came to the Judiciary Committee. We also are the committee that reviews whether or not counties should be able to establish new judicial positions. And I mentioned gun violence. And then just like kind of esoteric legal issues. Like, we had a very fun bill, I don't know if it was last year or 2 years ago, on decanting, the decanting of trusts, right? Only a lawyer and a very rare lawyer would care about that, but it is an important bill. So lots of different topics.
Is the Judiciary Committee, is it mainly comprised of lawyers?
It's a real mix. Right now, I think half or a little bit over half of the members are lawyers. There's no rule per se about this, but as generally a lawyer chairs that committee, and it's been, no one can really remember a time when a lawyer didn't chair it.
How are representatives normally selected? Is it sort of a mix of party first and then seniority?
Well, actually, no. It's very interesting, I think. So first of all, whichever party has the majority in the House gets to appoint more members to the committee than the other party. So there's always, because the Democrats control the House, there's always more Democratic members of the Judiciary Committee than Republican members. And there's actually a formula in the House of what the balance is. So we don't get to put like 20 Democrats and 2 Republicans because it's a very close split right now. It's a close split on the committee, too. But then the way you get on the committee is a group called the Committee on Committees appoints you to the committee. And so if you're a new member, when you're elected, you're educated a little bit about all the committees, and then you submit a preferences to your party leadership about which committees you want to serve on. And then we worked, I'm on the committee on committees, we really worked to try and appoint people who to the committees that they want to be on. And likewise, the Republicans do that. So the Democrats appoint their own members, the Republicans appoint their own members. Generally, chair positions go by leadership, but because judiciary kind of requires a lawyer, like I became chair of a committee in my third year in the legislature. That's fairly rare to have happen.
Well, it sounds like the Committee on Committees has an important position and role too. And looking at the dynamics of people that are serving on committees, and I mean, you want collaboration. You don't want necessarily constant political dissension. I guess you're going to get that, but it's hard not to get that. But
yeah, I mean, and really, probably 90 to 95% of the bills that end up passing the House are wide bipartisan support for them. So it's the same way on the committee. Again, we really try and appoint committee members based on their interests. But some of it is just like technical stuff. Like you have these 20 committees. You can't appoint a member to a committee who has another committee at the same time. Mm. So just figuring out the mechanics of having people not have overlapping committee schedules and things like that. So individual members have to prioritize. The caucuses have to look out for things. And
so as chair of the Judiciary Committee, do you do you get to set the agenda? Do you get to decide which bills go before the committee? Do you decide when there's sort of public debate, the meeting times, all that sort of?
That's really the power of the chair. The Committee on Committees sets the meeting times. We get some influence over that, but I, as chair, generally get to decide what bills I'm interested in hearing and not hearing. Now, I usually ask members to tell me, Republican and Democrat, what are your priority bills? I try to hear the priority bills of members, or at least that's how I decide. There are topic areas, for example, mental health has been a huge issue over the last number of years, so we devote a number of days to mental health care hearings. Gun violence is something that's been very important to me, so I've been trying to expand the number of bills that we hear on gun violence. But that is the power of the chair, is to decide what to hear and what not to hear. So, for example, I mentioned a couple of years ago, we had a number of bills targeting the transgender community, and I announced early on, I'm not hearing any of those bills. It's not what we stand for. I am not going to give voice to it. And it's one of the things that helped kill the bills in the Senate, because senators said, why should I bother voting for this bill or doing something about this when she's awful and she said she won't hear them? I mean, you know, there are people who are critical about it, but that is the power of the chair.
And do you think that the real work of the legislature happens through the committees? Is that where the sort of the work in the trenches takes place?
Absolutely, because we're the ones who hear all the real substance of a bill. If you're not on a committee, you end up hearing about the bill when it comes to the floor to be voted on. Now, that's the other thing that a chair has to do. So, for example, every bill that's been out of judiciary that we voted out of committee, I brief my caucus on that bill. So I don't remember how many we had this year, maybe 60 bills that I briefed our caucus on. Mm. But the substance of working out amendments to the bill and perfecting the bill, it may be shocking to people, but not every bill that's filed is perfect right when it's filed. And so the committee hearings are really the time where you hear disagreements or issues in bills and you try and fix those problems and get it to a place where it can go to the floor in a more perfected way.
I always thought that, and this is me not understanding the process that well, but I always thought that you guys were meeting in some swanky bar over at the state legislature with in some dark room with a lawyer type furniture with a shaggy carpet on the walls and good drinks. And I asked Mike Policiati about that, and he said, no, Noah, that's not where the work gets done. And so it apparently is the committees. You guys are actually drinking coffee or tea, and you guys are getting the work done in the committee and not meeting in some smoky room to do some back, you know, some handshake deal or something.
Although, as a Wisconsin girl, last year I had to fight to get real cream for the coffee, and I won.
All right. You're listening to Know Your Rights on Clay, 1180 AM. Stay with us.
Deal Talk. To make sure my new Spicy Chicken Club combo is a great value, I asked a sales expert.
It's amazing, Jack! You get a spicy, crispy chicken breast, hickory smoked bacon, and melted cheese on toasted sourdough, plus fries and a drink. All in one delicious deal.
You said it, Stanley.
Ow. Wait, what's happening?
Stanley? Stanley, you're deflating!
I'm so cold.
We need a doctor!
Jack, tell my wife I love her.
No! Try my new Spicy Chicken Club Combo. Another great deal from Jack in the Box.
Hi, I'm Noah from Noah Your Rights, the show that helps educate you on your legal rights and resources available to you. You know, I want to be your lawyer, but more than that, I want to help empower you. I want to help provide you the tools that you need to be successful in your case, whether you hire me or you hire someone else. I want you to check out our website, www.noahyourrights.com. See what resources are there. See how we can help you. And if there's something that's missing, email me at noah@noahyourrights.com, and we'll see what we can do to add the material that you need to be successful in your case.
Yeah, you, it's me, your heart. Listen to me. We've got to talk. High blood pressure is serious, and yours? Whoa, what happened to us? We used to be so much more active. But lately, you've been ignoring me. I know you think I'm just going to keep ticking away forever, but you're wrong. You can do so much more to control your high blood pressure. Doing the minimum isn't doing enough. I'm under a lot of pressure and can quit whenever I want. Bet you didn't know that. But I like my job. Just treat me better. Check on me. Give me something green to nibble on every once in a while. And maybe we can do some exercise on occasion. Let's get to it. After all, we're in this together.
Listen to your heart. Don't let it quit on you. High blood pressure can lead to a stroke, heart attack, or death. Get your blood pressure to a healthy range before it's too late. Find out how at heart.org/bloodpressure. Check, change, control. A message from the American Heart Association, the American Stroke Association, and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to Noah Your Rights, the show dedicated to helping you, the listener, be educated and informed about your legal rights and resources available to you. You can check out our website, www.noahyourrights.com, for more information about this program, me, and upcoming programming on KLAY1180.com. If you want to call in and ask us some questions on today's topic, we're interviewing Lori Jenkins from the 27th District, Washington State House of Representatives. The telephone number is 253-581-0324. So, Lori, we're talking about some of the work the Judiciary Committee does, and you chair that particular committee. And I went online before today's segment, and I checked out some of the past work that you did earlier this year. And I was amazed at how many bills come before your committee. I mean, there's so many. And obviously, I'm a lawyer. The laws impact my practice, depending on, and I do a general practice, so I'm engaged in a lot of different areas of the law. It was hard for me to keep up, and it's hard just going online and looking at the number of bills that you have. The pace is incredible, and there's so much information that's coming before you. I know that there's some staff lawyers that you have, but just the workload, I mean, it seems pretty incredible. And you guys are meeting like three times a week or something like that while you're in session. So is it a little bit overwhelming at times?
It is. It is a lot. And I mentioned this earlier in the show, but the Judiciary Committee is the highest volume committee in the legislature. So it has more bills referred to it than any other committee in the legislature. So we had well over 100 bills referred to us. You know, and you have some committees who are able to hear maybe like two bills per hearing. On average, we're hearing between 5 and 6 bills per 2-hour time slot.
Wow.
So you really have to focus. And
cut off debate sometimes, right?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of committees don't time people at all. Nearly every committee hearing I have, I put people on a 2-minute timer so they get 2 minutes to kind of give their case and have to be really focused about it. The one thing that I would never want to understate is the staff that we have. That's the reason that we're able to actually understand legislation and process it and process amendments and things like that so that we can really perfect bills. But we're varying wildly sometimes between amazingly different topics. And I guess the longer I'm there, one of the things that happens, I'm like, okay, well, we've heard this bill before, you know, and so, you know, sometimes I'll be like, I'm going to schedule this for a hearing. I can tell you who's going to testify. I can tell you what they're going to say, and I can tell you how it's going to turn out right now. But nonetheless, like, it might be a member's number one bill that they really want heard. And I'm like, okay, and you might find a solution to bring the parties together so that we can actually move this along. So good luck. Let's go.
So sometimes you're having these bills come up repeatedly from session to session.
Yeah.
Yeah, they just get reintroduced and the same speakers. And maybe they're doing that because the vote's close, or maybe because there's just such a political push behind a particular bill.
Yeah, and I mean, and this goes too to the discussion earlier about incrementalism. Like, sometimes folks will say, well, I'm going to file a bill and I just want a hearing about it. Okay, so that's their step for success 1 year. The next year, they want to move it out of committee. Well, we'll see if we can get the votes then, right? And so there's a lot of process steps before something gets to the governor's desk to be signed. So part of this is the advocates really understanding what's a rational approach for a particular bill. There are also bills that make it from beginning to end, first time out. You know, so it just really depends on how controversial the bill is.
How much pressure sometimes behind some
of
the bills?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's kind of funny. A lot of, we do get local government bills, definitely in the Judiciary Committee. And one of my kind of funny experiences is that local governments will frequently bring bills and they'll say, we've worked this with all the stakeholders, everyone is fine. And then they're the groups that are that most frequently this happens. And I'll be like, okay, I'll schedule a hearing. Everybody hates the bill. Right. Everybody says, we didn't know anything about this. And the bill definitely then will have to be reworked and probably brought back the next session. But I almost predict it to happen with local government bills. I'm not sure what that is. I think maybe because local government operates in different ways than the state legislature. Stakeholder input is just viewed differently.
Yeah, well, they're looking from an efficiency point of view, it seems. How do we enact things to make it more efficient? And maybe they don't have the type of public hearings that the rest of everyone else is used to. And I saw one of the local ones, which was commissioners on the municipal court trying to give them like full judicial powers. I don't know if that passed or not, but that was something I probably wouldn't support because, you know, judges are elected and the commissioners are appointed by the judges, and I don't want to duplicate. It seems to me, and without getting into a full debate about that, but just seems like there's obviously a real difference between a commissioner and a judge, and I want to keep the judges and not, and the commissioners. They have a role to play, but I wouldn't want to give them the full judicial powers of the elected officials.
Yeah, I don't remember if that bill passed or not, but every commissioner decision, you can make a motion for reconsideration or a motion for revision to have an elected judge review the case. So, I mean, I do think, though, that proposal is about judicial efficiency.
It is,
and like how not that many cases that commissioners decide on. Is there that motion that's made? Do people know about it is another question, right?
Right. So talking about some more bills that came out of the Judiciary Committee and looking back over, I just looked at the first part of 2018 and I saw one on the wrongful death statute. And I don't know if this passed or not. And you can comment about that in a moment. But it seems that our wrongful death statute, I know it's changed over the years, and that's good to give a little bit more powers or remedies available to those persons that have been aggrieved by the loss of a loved one, especially when it's due to the wrongful conduct of someone else. And historically, maybe there was no right for a person to have, once someone was deceased, their kids or their parents or someone else wouldn't have a right to sue in their place. And the legislature's developed statutes to help that, to allow children to sue, to allow adult children to sue, to allow parents to sue, to allow, in some cases, siblings to sue. And there was a statute that sought to expand that a little bit, or a bill that sought to expand that a little bit, and to take away, I think, one requirement, which was a financial requirement, because I think the adult parents of parents of an adult child, also siblings of adult siblings of, or maybe they don't even have to be adult siblings, but the siblings, both the parents and the siblings, would have to prove financial reliance, financial support on the decedent in order to bring a claim. And that was only after the decedent didn't have any direct children of their own. Mm-hmm. So there were steps. So it was going to remove some of those, but then it did something else, I think. And that was, it was going to leave up to the jury to determine the damages. And it wasn't going to limit that, because I feel that the wrongful death statute does one thing that is extremely limiting, and it doesn't make sense to me. And that's that you can't be compensated for your loss of life, for your own loss of enjoyment and reduction in time that you were on this earth. And to me, that is almost the most valuable, because as we sit here today, we determine our lives. We don't want our lives to be cut short by someone else's negligence. And to not have a value on that, to me, just doesn't make any sense, because what the statute, as it currently is written, what it allows is for the income loss for that to be valued. Other people that sue on your behalf for negligence that caused the loss of life, they can recover for their own loss of companionship and affection that's affected them. But no one can sue for the loss of life of the decedent, if that makes sense. They can just sue for that lost income that that person would have had. So that means that someone that's homeless, unemployed, you know, not, they haven't been working for a while, maybe they're disabled, they don't have that same income stream, their life is worth less under the statute than someone that's a doctor or a lawyer. And to me, that just is not fair.
Hmm. Yeah, well, the statute, actually the primary two expansions in the bill were, one, Washington's the only state in the union that prohibits international families who are not from the U.S. from recovering. And so this bill was driven a lot by, if folks remember the accident with the ride, the Ducks ride, and the young people that were killed on that ride were actually international students. And their families in Washington State, we're the only state in the country, were prohibited for recovering in wrongful death because they are not U.S. citizens.
Their cases were dismissed.
Correct. They weren't actually filed because the statute of limitations hadn't run yet. So if the bill had passed, they would have been able to meet the statute of limitations. The statute of limitations will run this, I think, December. And so they won't be able to sue. Mm-hmm. The second thing, yes, has to do with, and we heard a lot of testimony about parents who had lost a child who was over the age of 18 in college, really through some horrible accidents. And one story, a 19-year-old young man went for a summer job, was not trained at all by the company that hired him, and was told to get up into an auger and unjam the auger, and was augged to death. Mm-hmm. In the auger, the company was actually found criminally liable, and the parents could not sue for wrongful death of their child. And so this was to expand and let parents sue for the wrongful death of a child, not in every circumstance, but when there was a close relationship could be established. So those were the two major expansions up to the bill. I guess I tend to look at the other kind of language in the bill as just mostly trying to make our wrongful death statutes be synchronized kind of throughout Washington state law. But we moved it out of committee and moved it to the floor of the House and came up a vote short on the floor of the House. The Senate did move the bill. I expect that the bill will come back this year. We had a lot of objections from local governments, and the folks who didn't like the bills were local governments generally, and the healthcare industry. Of course, there are a lot of there are wrongful death suits there. So this gets into the kind of whole tort holy war, and there's a rather constant tug and pull around expansion of tort liability,
right.
And it's a pretty tough thing to make that happen. I just would make one other quick comment about this. The family members who testified on these bills made it very clear that it wasn't really about the money, but it was about the legacy of their child. And so many of them had established foundations, yeah, and other things to stop what had happened to their child from happening to another child. Yeah. And the family members were just incredibly compelling.
Yeah, it's standing up for the right cause and standing up for that person who lost their life. And it's a very personal journey, definitely a personal journey, the wrongful death statute.
And we'll be back this next year, I'm sure, with another draft of the bill.
I want to talk about, in the last segment of our show, here coming up in a moment, I want to talk about a couple technical issues that came up last week with labor and industries, and then I want to go on to the Domestic Violence Protection Act and a couple other statutes, and we'll just address those real briefly. You're listening to Know Your Rights. We're here with Lori Jenkins.
Deal Talk. To make sure my new Spicy Chicken Club combo is a great value, I asked a sales expert.
It's amazing, Jack! You get a spicy, crispy chicken breast, hickory smoked bacon, and melted cheese on toasted sourdough, plus fries and a drink. All in one delicious deal!
You said it, Stanley.
Ow. Wait, what's happening?
Stanley? Stanley, you're deflating!
I'm so cold.
We need a doctor!
Jack, tell my wife I love
her. No! Try my new Spicy Chicken Club combo. Another great deal from Jack in the Box.
Hi, I'm Noah from Noah Your Rights, the show that helps educate you on your legal rights and resources available to you. You know, I want to be your lawyer, but more than that, I want to help empower you. I want to help provide you the tools that you need to be successful in your case, whether you hire me or you hire someone else. I want you to check out our website, www.noahyourrights.com. See what resources are there. See how we can help you. And if there's something that's missing, email me at noah@noahyourrights.com, and we'll see what we can do to add the material that you need to be successful in your case.
Dad, this is fun. I didn't think I'd like kayaking.
Well, I'm glad you enjoyed it. But I think it's time to head back in.
Okay. Can we come back?
Sure.
Tomorrow?
Let's check with Mom. Hey, be careful getting out of the boat.
It's a kayak, Dad.
I'm gonna return the kayak. Just make sure you have everything.
Yep. Can we walk home?
How about a taxi? 233 North Maple, please.
It's a short fare from your neighborhood to your naturehood. Visit discovertheforest.org to find a neighborhood park or green space near you. Also, find fun activities to do like boating and biking or camping and hiking, plus much more. It's all right in your naturehood.
Best day ever.
A public service announcement brought to you by the Ad Council and the U.S. Forest Service.
Welcome back to Know Your Rights, a show dedicated to helping educate you, the listener, on your legal rights and resources available to you. If you want to get in a call in this last segment, the number is 253-581-0324. We're talking politics, not really. We're talking judiciary. We're talking the legislature. We're talking with Lori Jenkins. We're talking about some of the bills that became law. We're talking about some bills that die in the committee that don't end up becoming law. And we're talking about things that, from a practical effect, how they play out in the real world after they become law. And I've got a couple of those examples that I want to put forth and talk to you about, Lori. But first, I want to follow up one more technical issue that I mentioned before the break. And that's I saw on the agenda for the Judiciary Committee that you have this public session and then you have an executive session. And I'm assuming that when you have sort of public debate among the representatives over a bill, you invite comments from the public, you have a public session. Other times when you're doing administrative work or you want to suss out the basis of a bill, maybe you have the executive session. Maybe you could talk a little bit about the distinction there.
Yeah, it's very different than what you see in local government. So when we have public hearings, the bill is introduced and any member of the public who comes is generally able to come and testify. Again, they might be limited by time. And for example, when I hear firearm bills, we devote a whole full 2 hours to it, and we could probably have a whole day's worth of testimony. So typically everybody who signs in doesn't get to testify on those, but I usually invite them to provide written testimony. The executive session during in the legislature is actually when the legislators themselves are debating a bill, and that's done publicly. So we're in the committee in open committee hearings, but somebody's moving amendments. People are moving amendments. They either get adopted or rejected, and that's when we decide to either vote to move a bill out of committee and on to its next stop, or we don't. We vote it down. It's very rare that we actually vote something down because I, as chair, count the votes. And if I don't have the votes, I don't actually bring it up to be moved.
Interesting.
But one of the other differences between the state legislature and like local government is our individual caucuses we get to meet privately about the bills. Outside of a public meeting, we meet privately about the bills and we talk about them. The Republican caucus does, the Democratic caucus does. So usually what happens is we have a public hearing on a bill, and then I usually let about a week go by for folks to work on amendments for the bills. And then a week later, we will have an executive session. And before that, we'll break into caucuses. The caucuses will discuss the bills that we're considering moving. And then we'll come out and decide, are we going to have a fight about it? Are we all going to agree about it? Is there an amendment that's necessary to get more votes for the bill that's acceptable? And then we move the bills out.
If it goes to the full House, they can send it back too for amendment if there's debate there and there's enough reason to send it back.
I have not had that happen in my 5 years. What usually happens is there are amendments on the floor of the House. So we do lots of amendments on the floor on bills. So that means that's when any member can. You have to be a member of the committee in order to amend the bill in committee. And so if you're a member but not on committee, you got to wait till it comes to the floor. Or maybe you can talk to one of your colleagues who will amend, who will carry your amendment in committee.
And if the House votes on passing the bill, it goes over to the Senate. If they make amendments, those amendments are going to have to come back for debate and passage again, aren't they?
Correct. So the bill, what happens is if a bill starts off in the House, then it goes to the Senate and passes the House. It goes to the Senate. If they make amendments and pass it, then we need to decide whether or not we're going to concur. And there's all kinds of things we can do. We can concur. We can decline to concur and insist that they take the bill as we sent it over. There's many different kind of technical options that we can take to try and get something finally to the governor's desk. And this year I had at least one experience where I used every single tool in my toolbox to finally get a bill to the governor's desk.
The political plays that take place, I mean, they're so difficult sometimes to perhaps guess on or to know what's going to come up, what political crises or political issues are behind some of the bills or the reasons why people vote on certain things. So that's, I think, hard to predict in advance. I want to talk to you about three particular subject areas: domestic violence and the Domestic Violence Protection Act, the anti-SLAPP statute, and then public disclosure law. We're not going to have a whole lot of time to cover those in any detail. So I'm going to do something unusual. I'm going to throw those three topics back at you and say, which one do you want to start with? The Domestic Violence Protection Act, the anti-SLAPP statute, or public disclosure law?
Well, let's start with the anti-SLAPP statutes, and in part because I think this deals a lot with the Me Too movement, and it's something that we should probably be doing some work on.
So for those of you out there that aren't that familiar with anti-SLAPP legislation, the SLAPP stands for, the SLAPP part of the anti-SLAPP stands for Strategic Lawsuits Against Public Participation, and that's found at Washington 424-500, so 424-500. Anti-SLAPP statutes are designed to protect whistleblowers who report illegal conduct. It shields them from a countersuit for, say, defamation, for reporting, like, for example, a ship dumping toxic waste out in the bay. You call in to the state environmental regulatory department and say there's a ship out there dumping toxic substances. They investigate. Maybe there's a news report about it. Next thing you know, there's a big shipping company suing that individual for defamation or libel, saying that they made this false report to try to shut them up. Because that's the old days, what you would do. You'd have Monsanto or some of these other big corporations that would sue individuals to target them to end up, because they couldn't support the pay the legal fees, to shut them up and have them retract stories or to give up particular complaints. So anti-SLAPP is there to protect these individual whistleblowers. The problem is, there's two problems, at least. I mean, there's probably, with every issue, there's, you know, a lot of problems. And laws, the process isn't always necessarily clean or straightforward. There's no perfect answer for a lot of the legal problems we have in this world, right? And you guys in the legislature are trying to address those the best you can. Well, the anti-SLAPP legislation was struck down in part by the Washington Supreme Court, and that was a Davis versus Cox, COX decision, and that was 2015. it didn't strike down the whole statute. It just struck down part of it as not providing the right to a jury trial. So we still have part of the statute out there. The problem that I have with the statute that still remains, and as much as I'm behind it, you know, protect whistleblowers and the Me Too movement, because there are, I saw one of the new Seattle Seahawks is suing one of his accusers. She accused him of sexual assault, and I believe he's filed a lawsuit against her, saying it affected his draft placement and caused him damages and that sort of thing. So it's being used as people are targeting, and Trump threatens to do this all the time too.
Right, and I think his record shows that actually he's done it a whole bunch of times.
Absolutely, yeah. It's a way that people can continue to bully and abuse others, and you file a countersuit back against them. So that we need the protections out there. These statutes are important. But I had a case, and I'm not going to be able to get into all the facts, but it was used in a divorce case, and the base allegations are that the wife, who is now divorced, called the police on the husband, who there's a court order said he was supposed to come over and pick up things from the house. Well, there's also a restraining order. And so she just showed the restraining order to the police, not the court order that said, go over to the house and get your things the last day before the house sold. And so he was prosecuted. Eventually he was dismissed when the prosecutor got all the records, but there were still damages because the client had to pay a lawyer to defend him. So he sued the ex-wife for malicious prosecution. They then defended with anti-SLAPP statute. So it went up to the Court of Appeals twice. And I mean, you're talking about tens of thousands of dollars later. The problem that I had with that example is that it doesn't seem that the statute is really made for domestic relations sort of issues, reporting conduct to the police, because that's not public participation or matters of public importance. But they're made out to be. They're made out, well, reporting to the police want to know about the conduct of the individuals. But I don't think that's what anti-SLAPP is for. It's not to be used in like a personal vendetta type case, but that's where it is being used. And the Me Too movement it can be like that too. And so I guess I'm interested in your input or your response to that about the anti-SLAPP idea being a noble one, but then how it's being used.
Yeah, well, first of all, one of the things I'd mention is for listeners is that SLAPP lawsuits are filed with no real intention of winning. Right. Generally, the person who files it doesn't think they're going to win, but what they're trying to do is slow down a process or harass to get to just have someone voluntarily walk away. I think that the example that you give is it's a challenging one, because the portion of the statute that still remains in place does protect somebody from reporting to a governmental entity. And you definitely want to protect that. I think that the issue if somebody's going to use it in an aggressive form like that, the anti-SLAPP statute, then I think what you're going to have to look at is their lawyers, filing. As a lawyer, you do have to certify that you think that you can win on your lawsuit and some things like that. So there are some other kind of tangential things that can come into play on this that can hopefully govern it a little bit. Although, most of the statute's been struck down, and I think we're having a very hard time trying to figure out how to draft anything more constitutional at this point.
Well, I might end up having some suggestions I'll forward to you about the standard, whether it should be good faith or bad faith or reasonable person standard, or whether there should be attorney fees or statutory attorney fees. And I might have some ideas based on my own case. But I really appreciate you addressing that particular issue. I'm sorry we didn't get into some of these other issues that were of great sort of impart to our listeners. But this has been a great show. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks a lot, Noah, and I'm happy to come back anytime. It's a pleasure to be out here.
Well, we would love to have you come back for part two and address some of these other issues that we didn't get to. For those of you out there, thanks so much for joining us this last hour. You've been listening to Know Your Rights on KLAY 1180 AM. We'll see you next time.